Good morning to everyone. The word for this particular month is greatness, and the title that I have here is from a quote by Thomas Carlyle, a Scotsman during the 19th century, who was an essayist, a professor, a philosopher, and was one of those individuals who sort of was very knowledgeable and active in almost every field of study. When we want to know the meaning of a word, we go to the dictionary or to the internet. But if we want to know the emotional context of a word or a word's emotional intensity, we're on our own. And university students today are multiplying the emotional freight of words. Okay, could you flick one? Okay. This is from, this is from an Atlantic Magazine article which talks about what's happening on college campuses today. And because of this, a number of comedians, Chris Rock being one, no longer go to college campuses because they can no longer use humor on some of the things that cause discomfort or might cause offense. Then there are two words that have been added to our vocabulary from college campuses today. One is microaggressions, and the other is trigger warnings. And sometimes it might be interesting to get into those areas. But in addition to what's happening in the public discourse, I'm convinced that each one of us has individually a private repository of emotionally laden words. Words lurking in the corners of our minds, which when mentioned will trigger us back into a different part of our life. Perhaps it's the sweet pleasure of a long-ago love or the ecstatic exuberance of a once picture-perfect day or a time receiving a special recognition or award. On the other hand, there are also those emotional-laden words, degrading and demeaning childhood words, nicknames drilled at us, the remembrance of which can still bring a grimace, or there can be the immediate flooding of shame over a very embarrassing incident. I start here because the selected word for this month, greatness, in spending some time mulling on that word, I was surprised that this innocuous, nondescript, everyday word touched an emotional spot within me. Normally for this talk, I would have just dealt with that word in a descriptive or in an abstract way. However, what I found myself spending time doing was trying to figure out what it was that was so troublesome about that word. Quite quickly, I discovered what it was that disturbed me about the word greatness. But it spent a lot more time leading through a lifelong personal history trying to find why it was disturbing. So this talk today is a little more personal than I normally would have wanted, but it was the only way I could adequately deal with the word greatness. And I hope that the process in which I engage in looking at this word might be a model for you to piece together some, perhaps an important thread in your own life. My irritable reaction to the word greatness is triggered by the numerous politicians and other public speakers who repeatedly claim that our country is the greatest nation on the face of this earth. I know that this is one of those rhetorical sentences that so easily rolls off the tongue and unobtrusively flows into the echo chamber of hearers' minds. My mind, though, is not a passive receptacle for the greatest nation message. Each time I hear that phrase, I find myself wanting to argue, or at least, at a minimum, discuss that assertion. Are we really the greatest nation? In what way is that true or not true? And what is the definition of greatness? Or, as some have asserted, are we really God's gift to the human race? As you probably noted by now, I have a bit of skepticism about all of these comments. Identifying my discomfort with the word greatness was the easy part of this talk. Tracing why it is that I have this discomfort led to a much more difficult review of my life. How did that become such a problematic word for me? Okay. I can't claim a child at any more dramatic than most, but it certainly provides a background as to the process that I went through in finding this comment that we are the greatest nation somewhat distasteful. I grew up in the Second World War, the good war, as Studs Terkel labeled it. It was a time of real national unity, and it's hard to envision this today, given the conflict that we have in our society. There was a national unity in fighting the Axis powers. Everybody was under rationing, tire, sugar, gas, and meat, among other things. Even though there were some people who manipulated the system, for the most part, there was a unified effort by the full population of the country. And there was something else that unified people during that period of time, and that was death, the possibility of death. To walk down the street, one could look at the windows of the small houses lining the streets of that day and see small cloth banners about that size. Some would have a silver star, some a gold star. The silver star meant that a son was in the armed services. A banner with a gold star meant that a son had been killed. And so there was a kind of daily reality, not just in the newspapers, but also on the streets, that death was a reality. In addition, following there were some good things that the United States did. One was the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe. And then there was the GI Bill, which provided free education and home financing for returning veterans. Now, they weren't totally altruistic bills, but nevertheless, altruism was a strong element in those. And it was the kind of a thing that we as citizens could take pride in. So I came out of childhood with a childlike patriotism and a love for the country. This kind of childhood naivete began to erode when I went to college, and in the most unlikely of places, a small college in conservative state of South Dakota. What I learned there was part of South Dakota's history was the massacre at Wounded Knee. It occurred on December 29th in 1890. The anniversary of that was just 5 days ago. And it was near Wounded Knee Creek on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. The 7th Cavalry, opening fire indiscriminately on all sides, killed roughly 200 men, women, children, as well as some fellow soldiers. Some Indians who escaped in the sub-zero temperature were hunted down in the snow. Okay. I'm going to have to catch up here now. Okay, go ahead. Let me make a comment on this, then I'll get back to the top. I'm not the only one who has some questions about whether the United States is the leading, the greatest country. And you can see that from 2011 to 2014, that more people are thinking that it is. Okay? And I pulled up this one just to show you why the message of Donald Trump is so resonates so much among Republicans when he says that he wants to make America great again. As you can see, from 2011 to 2014, among Republicans, there's been a drop of 15% who believe that the country is great or on the right road. And so it's a kind of message that's resonating at least among that group. Now I want to get back to the term again. This is a picture of Wounded Knee that was taken, and the temperature was well below zero. So it, and these are just bodies that were frozen on the ground. And why did Wounded Knee happen? Because the U.S. government had signed a treaty with Indians, setting aside the Black Hills as a sacred place. But something happened that changed that, the discovery of gold. And suddenly the whole area was opened up to the seekers for gold. And the government made it possible that the Indians were pushed out and whites could not only get the gold but also get the land. So in college in South Dakota, I learned about my country violating a treaty, grabbing land, randomly killing those who legally claimed the Black Hills as to be their home. There was a second land grab in this country that I learned from my college roommate, a native Hawaiian. In 1893, there was a group of American sugar planters under Stanford Ballard Dole. Remember the cans of Dole pineapples? And he overthrew the Hawaiian monarch, established a new provisional government with Dole as president. And this was done with the foreknowledge of John Stevens, who was the U.S. minister to Hawaii at that time. And it happened, of course, not coincidentally, that a ship was offshore. 300 U.S. Marines from the U.S. cruiser simply landed and took over the islands. So in college, there was starting to be an erosion, a serious erosion, of my feelings about this being the greatest nation. Here in this little college, I was hearing about the takeover of the Black Hills, violating a treaty, and the takeover of another country. Getting out of college was took me out of that kind of awareness of what was going on in terms of U.S. history. But a contemporary history was taking place at that time in the 60s, and that was Vietnam. Now, some of you who remember, who are part of those days, remember the turmoil that was going on in this country, significant turmoil. It's hard to even imagine some of the things happening today that were happening back then. But there was a lot of other information that was coming forth at that time that was starting to undercut my feeling about America being the greatest nation. It comes to a focus in Lena Horne. She was asked to perform, and she did perform before audiences of service personnel. When it was in the Midwest, where there were large concentration camps of German soldiers, she was asked to sing there. In front were the POWs, the Germans, the whites, and behind were the African-American soldiers. She said she would only sing if the group was desegregated, And they refused, the army refused to do that, so she walked back and stood before the second part of the audience, forcing the German soldiers to turn around. Then in a movie with Cary Grant, and I think it was Cary Grant, Lena Horne and Cary Grant shook hands. And when that movie was distributed in the United States, when it went through the South, that segment of shaking hands, the first time that African American and a white in a movie had that kind of contact, it was cut out. Something else happened that was even more dramatically significant in terms of my shift away from this idea that America is the greatest country in this world. My wife, I, and our two children went over to Turkey, and we were there for 5 years. We were officially missionaries, but in a Muslim country, teaching and school administration is what we did, not church work. It was a time when I was drawn again into a more actively critical view of this country. It was the Cold War, and one of the policy of the United States was to surround the Soviet Union to contain it. Turkey borders the Soviet Union, not only in land but also in the Black Sea. And we talked Turkey into having missiles so that it would be a first line protection for some of the rest of the world. Of course, if Turkey has missiles, what does that mean if the Soviet Union did decide to strike? Turkey would be one of the first places hit. And they did this. But a couple of years later, when the Cuban Missile Crisis came along, and Russian missiles were going to be put in Cuba close to our shore, we defused that. And one of the side agreements was that we would take out the missiles out of Turkey. But we didn't tell Turkey that. We didn't negotiate with them. We just did it on our own. So here is a friend there going along with our policy in order to protect this country and the rest of the world. And when it comes to protecting ourselves, we toss them aside. There was another thing that happened, but that would take a little too much time. And I began to realize that the United States is not as benevolent toward other countries as I had originally thought. A second thing happened in Turkey, and that was that in the 1960s, we were there from 64 to 69, there was a tremendous flow of Americans who had left the States and were roaming Europe and the Middle East quite often to escape the draft. But they were intelligent, they were convinced, they were knowledgeable. And added to that, there were the 400 or so Peace Corps workers that were in Turkey at that time. And from these individuals, there came a continual story of what was happening in this country and the imposition of a war on people that they didn't want to fight. The third part of... go ahead and hit one more. The third part of what happened in Turkey was a realization that America is not going to last forever. Civilization after civilization washed over that area of the world. And I put this up just to do some of the empires that existed at that time. We are now in the 239th year of American independence and as a country. The Hittites had 422 years. The Seleucids were 249 years. The Byzantines were an empire for 1125 years. And the Ottomans were an empire for 624 years. What does it mean to be the greatest country in the world when visibly, we could see the remnants of other empires that existed, had existed in that part of the world. Where are they today? How long will this, as the greatest country in the world, exist? It was just a question that was being asked. Do you remember the poem Ozymandias by Shelley? Okay. I want you to keep that picture in mind while we go to the next one and you see the poem. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survived, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair. No other, no thing besides remains round the decay of that colossal wreck. Boundless and brave, the lone and level sands stretch far away." So the experience in Turkey was an experience of, once again, of seeing America in a very different light. Well, one might expect that with all that I've said so far, I should be renouncing my citizenship. That's not the case. Having lived for 5 years outside of this country, I learned that no country has bridged the gap between its ideals and its reality, and that the United States, because of its unique history as a nation, is more susceptible than other nations to violating its ideals. Actually, I may have had a heightened sense of citizenship, having sloughed through the unsavory aspects of this country's history, and I still affirm its values and many of its actions. What I do find objectionable is ignoring our history and puffing up this country into the greatest nation on the earth. Rhetorically, I understand why politicians say that, but it maintains a narrative about this country that is bad for public policy and interferes with reasonable foreign policy. One of my favorite quotes comes from the margin of a medieval manuscript, and it has stayed with me because it helped me wend my way through many of the organizations of which I've been a part. Actually, monks put a lot of their frustrations into marginal notes, and scholars find these all the time as they're reading through the manuscripts. "The hours were long, the rooms were cold, the taskmasters often pushed the monks to work harder and faster. And one monk wrote as a marginal note, 'The church is like Noah's Ark. You couldn't stand the stench inside if it weren't for the storm outside.'" That application, that sentiment has application to many areas of our lives, especially corporate areas. So finally, I want to bring this deconstruction of the word to an end. The title came from Thomas Carlyle, as I mentioned, a 19th century Scottish philosopher, essayist, satirist, historian, and mathematician. He's known for one thing, for coining the term the dismal science to refer to economics. And he wrote the words that I've used for the title of this talk: "We have not the love of greatness, but the love of the love of greatness." If politicians would begin to talk about the greatness of America and say, "This is what it means to be great," that would be one thing. But just to stand and say, that we need to be a great country. We are a great country, and to not give any substance to that is not the best. We can call ourselves the greatest nation in this world, not because we are, but because we like the idea of being great. It's not just the country, it's individuals. You remember Muhammad Ali when he won the world championship? He stood in the ring and said, "I am the greatest." And we have a person, Donald Trump, doing the same thing today. We have not the love of greatness, but the love of the love of greatness. In the coming weeks, I'm sure that some of the other speakers are going to be talking more about the substance of greatness. And I would like to be here for that, to hear what they have to say. But I just wanted to deconstruct the word itself so that there's a firmer base on which to move into that kind of understanding.